A lot of us might think of peer pressure as a bad thing. We usually hear it in relation to risky behaviors, things like smoking, underage drinking, and more. Peer pressure, more technically behavioral contagion, is a powerful psychological tool. It's why a friend or group of people can get us to do something we might not want to do on our own. But our next guest says that because peer pressure can be such a motivating force, we might be able to use it to address urgent matters, get some positive change, including on issues like climate change. Robert H. Frank is the Henrietta Johnson Lewis Professor of Management and Professor of Economics at Cornell's Johnson Graduate School of Management. He's the author of the new book, Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. Robert, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
I want to start with a couple of the basic comments that underline topics that underline your argument here. First is this idea of behavioral contagion and how powerful it can be. Can you talk to us about that?
You know, the most powerful example I've ever seen, I came across in a film. It was a candid camera film. Alan Funt, the candid camera creator, advertised a great job, high pay, no requirements to speak of. Lots of people applied. They came. They were instructed to sit down in a waiting room. When the subject showed up, there were already four other people in there waiting. We knew they were Confederates of Alan Funt, but he didn't know that. So after a while, we see the camera zoom in on the subject's face. He's impassive. But then suddenly he looks alarmed. The camera pans out, and we see that the reason for his alarm is that the other four, at no apparent signal, have stood up and have started taking off all their clothing. What's going on, he's wondering. And you can see, finally, he gets a more calm expression, and he, too, stands up and takes off all of his clothing. And the scene ends. They're all five standing there naked, waiting for what comes next. And people see this, or at least I did, in the film, and I say to myself, no way would I have done that. But think about it from the perspective of the candidate. It's a much better job than he's got. He doesn't know what's going on. The other four got there before he did. They know what's going on, if anybody does. They seem to think it's worthwhile to go through the next step in the drill. And so what's he to do? It's very hard to find fault with him for being influenced so strongly by his peers in that situation. It seems silly in hindsight, but he didn't know that. And in general, we know very little about what's going on out there in the world. Other people are ignorant, too. But together, others know a lot more than we do. And when we see others taking action confidently, it's at least incumbent on us to ask whether it might be a good thing for us to investigate whether it makes sense to do what they're doing. It won't always, obviously, but sometimes it will.
And on a more serious issue, you consider throughout your book smoking. And the same person, if we grew up in a different time or amidst a different circle, depending on how many people we knew who smoked, that has a big influence on our own ultimate decision on whether to smoke.
Exactly. Yeah, I have four adult sons. None of them smokes. I think if they'd grown up when I did, two or three of them would be smokers. And how can any parent not think of the change in the environment that we've seen happen as anything other than a good thing? It's, of course, a good thing that only 13-14% of the adults in America smoke now. It used to be over 60% when I was a teenager. And you're much, much harder pressed to raise your kids to be non-smokers if many of the people out there in their friendship groups are smokers.
Talking to Robert H. Frank, his new book is Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. That's behavioral contagion, but you can't just count on it happening on its own. And that takes us to another concept I'm quoting here, the idea that we should tax activities that cause harm to others, that can help steer behavioral contagion in the right direction. Can you expand on that that idea?
Yeah, I think there the smoking example is, again, the easiest way to see the underlying point. When you smoke, do you cause harm to others? When we started taxing smoking and regulating it, the excuse we offered was the fact that side stream smoke, secondhand smoke, had been shown to cause injury to others. It was responsible for various illnesses. And that was our rationale. But in fact, the harm from side stream smoke is trivial compared to the harm from actually being a smoker. And the real harm that you do to others when you're a smoker is to make them more likely to smoke. The people who have a big interest in this, the parents of children whom they don't want to see start smoking, have no recourse. You know, if there are many more smokers in the environment, many of those parents will fail in their goal of raising their kids to be non-smokers, and that's harm you've caused to those people if you're a smoker. So unless you think you just have a right to harm others without consequence, it's very hard to object to the fact that the government is trying to discourage you from smoking and thereby discourage you from causing harm to others. So yeah, I think we have clearly an interest in the social environment. We know how powerful its influence is on us. And so when it's a helpful thing to us, we want to encourage behaviors that reinforce that environment. And when it has a distinctly negative influence on us, I think, as in the smoking example, it's useful for us to take steps to discourage that kind of environment.
Now, an argument you might get, actually, you're right, an argument you have gotten is that, well, hold on, if I'm a smoker, yeah, maybe there's this behavioral contagion, but ultimately that other person, it's their choice. They're going to make the decision to smoke or not. So don't put that on me and don't tax me or punish me based on my hypothetical influence on that person over there. How do you answer them?
You know, when I hear that objection, I'm very sympathetic to the sentiment that motivates it. We do tell our children that they're responsible for their own decisions, that if they see peers behaving in a way that they know they shouldn't, that it's up to them to resist any temptation to follow those examples. So yes, I like the sentiment that motivates that objection, but think about the parents. Forget about the people causing harm to themselves. It's their responsibility to avoid that, you might hold. But the parents, they've done everything they can to discourage their kids from smoking. You can't push too far or you'll make them more likely to smoke. So they've taken every step possible to discourage their kids from smoking. We know that many of them are going to fail to achieve that goal in an environment in which most of their kids' peers are smokers. And so you're causing harm to those parents by making them unable to achieve a perfectly realistic and laudable goal. Why don't we count that as harm? It's a very palpable harm, really.
So let's take that to global warming, an issue that you talk about in the book, something you say we need to tackle. How do we operationalize this, the power of behavioral contagion on the one hand, and then the idea of taxing activities that cause harm to others to encourage positive behavioral contagion? How does that all come together to help fight climate change?
Well, we know that one of the most powerful explanations for why we do what we do is that other people like us are doing those things. When I was getting married, I had never heard of a destination wedding. Now my kids go to destination weddings all over the world. They're expected to. Some of my sons lately have been expected to go to destination bachelor parties. This is burning up a lot of fuel. There's absolutely no evidence that people would be any less happy if they got married closer to home. We do these trips because others like us are doing them. And so if we would price in the carbon in those trips, that would discourage people from scheduling them. If others didn't do them, we would feel no compunction to do them. The very most important finding is that if others weren't buying the things they're buying, we would feel no need to buy them either in many domains. So the heavy vehicles that Americans started buying, now they're 7,000-8,000 pounds. If you don't have one and others do, you're at greater risk of injury and death. If you buy a bigger one and they buy a bigger one, then the rub is that everybody's at greater risk of injury and death than if everybody were driving a small vehicle. And we don't have to assume that big vehicles are just automatically the right choice. If we taxed vehicles by weight, we'd discourage people from buying big ones. Some would buy smaller, then others would be less at risk. They'd buy smaller too, and we'd see that cascade go in exactly the opposite direction. And the nice twist to that is that we would raise some revenue if we did that. And the revenue we raise in the process, we could use to offset the current taxes we levy on useful activities. Why should we tax business payrolls? That discourages firms from hiring workers. We should reduce those taxes. Tax harmful activities. Every dollar you raise lets you reduce the tax on a useful activity.
We're talking to Robert Frank from the Cornell Graduate School of Management. He's with us to talk about his new book, Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. He makes the case that we can use peer pressure to influence action on things like climate change, among other things. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea so far, the idea that peer pressure can be an effective motivator and that by taxing things in a different way, we can encourage people to act in ways that that help the society, the planet as a whole, help fight climate change? What questions do you have for our guests about how this all might work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the idea of using peer pressure, behavioral contagion, to fight things like climate change. Economist Robert H. Frank is with us. His new book is called Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that peer pressure can be an effective tool to change people's minds about pressing issues, their behaviors? Have you seen it with, you know, things in your daily life? Was it easier, say, for you to quit smoking if you were around friends who were non-smokers or vice versa? What do you think of the idea of raising taxes on things that we know might lead to this kind of negative behavior, things like increased cigarette taxes or maybe increased taxes on carbon emissions? What do you think of that idea? Do you have a question for a guest about how this all works? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Robert, some people might say, you know, let's not tax things. Let's just regulate. Let's put limits on whatever pollutant we want, whether it's a greenhouse gas or a toxic chemical, we'll regulate it. That's the way to rein in whatever problem we have.
Yeah, we can do that, and we have done that. But economists argued for many decades that the more efficient and fair way to curb pollution is to charge people who pollute in accordance with how much they pollute. It's a myth that firms pollute because they enjoy polluting. That's such a silly idea of firm behavior. Firms pollute because it's costly to filter the pollution out. And economists for decades had been recommending taxes on SO2. When I first got to Cornell, all we read about was acid rain destroying the forests and fisheries here in the Northeast. Firms in the Midwest were discharging SO2 from their smokestacks, burning high sulfur coal. Once we finally enacted the economist's recommendation and charged people for emitting SO2 into the air, the concentrations of it fell sharply at about 1/6 the cost that had been projected under direct regulation, and we now never hear anything at all about acid rain. And that's something we should have also done long since with CO2. We knew CO2 was a problem back in the 1980s. There were reports that warming was already well underway. We have, though, resisted for the most part taxing CO2 emissions, and it's something we really ought to do. And again, nobody likes taxes, but if you say there shouldn't be any taxes, you're not really in the conversation. The question is, what should we tax and at what rate should we tax it? And right now, we're taxing a lot of useful things. Dumping carbon into the air is not a useful behavior. It's a harmful behavior. If we taxed it, we could reduce taxes on useful behavior. So that's really a compellingly advantageous step to take. And the added bonus is that when some respond by cutting back on their carbon emissions, the new habits they adopt turned out to have much more impact than anyone realized because they launch a contagion process among people that they know. So there's just a lot of easy fruit to be picked here.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Lynn is with us in Stevens Point. Lynn, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Lynn?
I was going to bring up, like, my kids when they were in from K through 12 had the option of either a vegetarian lunch or animal product in their lunch. And I think just the peer pressure of seeing that, seeing, oh, that it even existed, number one, and then that there's other choices, because animal protein, as we know, physical space it takes up and the amount of water to grow grain and to produce animal protein, I think that would be something that's peer pressure could, you know, just in, just for one thing, give people who aren't even aware that of how that impacts global, you know, climate change.
Lynn, thanks for the call. Robert, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a great point, and there's really very persuasive evidence of strong contagion in that domain. The study that's, I think, most dramatic was one that showed that when a military family was posted to a new location, if the obesity rate in the new location was 1% higher than where they had been, the adult members of the family in the new location were 5% more likely to become obese when they were moved to the new location. It's a huge effect. We don't understand fully all the mechanisms that produce it, but people do mimic the behavior of their peers in both diet and their exercise and other factors that are implicated. So we know that if some switch what they eat, others are going to be influenced by those decisions too.
Thanks, Lynn, for that call. We're talking to Robert H. Frank about his new book, Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work. We'll go back to your calls now. Tyler is with us in Green Bay. Tyler, hello.
Hi. I've got two comments for the guests, or two questions. First would be, would peer pressure possibly, peer pressure have a negative effect? In the sense, like, I think of social media, when people disagree with views, it's more of an attack. And then the second one is, I think an excise tax would be a really good idea, especially when a lot of times it's not things we have to do, but it's a choice we have to do those.
Tyler, thanks a lot for that call. First, that negative reaction, Robert, if we had, say, a lot of messages in front of us saying, you know, don't eat meat, eat vegetarian, or we've seen it with some people react to even anti-smoking messages this way, can it provoke the opposite response that you might be hoping for?
Yeah, I think when people feel like they're being preached at, there often is a reaction, and we see a counterproductive result in some of those cases. So I think setting a good example is often more powerful than trying to preach to somebody. There is at least research suggesting that. The tax approach is more neutral. And I think the tendency is to object to a tax because it's unpleasant to pay it. But in the case of the carbon tax, it's just been a failure of political imagination for leaders not to explain carefully to voters that we could make the carbon tax revenue neutral. And what that means is that they collect all the revenue that comes in from the tax, a disproportionate share of which would come from high-income consumers because they use much more energy per capita than others, and then give the revenue back to low and middle income families in equal monthly checks. And you'd find 80 to 90% of all voters getting more money back each month than they had actually paid in carbon taxes. It's still more expensive to do carbon intensive things, so everybody would still have a very strong incentive to cut back. But it would not be a burden on low and middle income families, as has often been charged. And I think it's a failure of political leadership not to explain that more clearly to the voters.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Gwen is with us in Madison. Gwen, hello.
Hello. My question or comment has to do with the carbon tax being passed on from the corporations to consumers. If a company is levied a carbon tax and they are selling a good or service to a consumer that is necessary, like heating for your home, and that cost is passed on to the consumer, it doesn't really change the corporate behavior. And people, especially in low-income groups, have very little leeway in how they, you know, spend their money.
Got it, Gwen. Thanks for the call. So, yeah, what do you think, Robert?
Yeah, that's the case just as clearly as it possibly could be made for making the tax revenue neutral. We want carbon-intensive activities to be more expensive, even for low-income families. We can cushion the blow to them by giving the revenue that we collect from those carbon taxes back to the families. So they'll have more money than before, many of them. And some object, well, doesn't that mean they'll still do wasteful things? No, because the energy-intensive choices will be more expensive relative to the energy-saving choices that they could have made. So they'll have just as strong an incentive to switch from high-carbon activities to low-carbon activities, but it will not be an unacceptable hardship for them in the process.
Thanks for the call, Gwen. In our last minute, Robert, you mentioned that one objection to tackling climate change in the U.S. is that, well, we're just part of the story. The rest of the world would need to get on board, too. Do you think in international relations there could be this sort of behavioral contagion, peer pressure?
Oh, we've seen it again and again. When Stockholm adopts a congestion fee, it was very unpopular at first, but then other countries and cities saw that it worked out quite well there. The motorists are really very much in favor of this measure now. Now there are many cities around the world suddenly willing to consider it because they've seen how it worked so well in Stockholm. And if we tax carbon and other countries don't, yeah, that would be a problem. But if they want to sell their goods here, we can tax the carbon content of their goods when they enter the country. And rather than let us keep the revenue from a carbon tax on their goods, they'll impose their own carbon tax. That's the best response they would have.
Robert, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Robert H. Frank, the Henrietta Johnson Lewis Professor of Management and Professor of Economics at Cornell University. He joined us for a look at his new book, Under the Influence, Putting Peer Pressure to Work, where he argues that peer pressure may be one of the most effective ways to combat climate change.